Session number 22071, Reel 2.
John Collier, Reel 2.
Yes, the other interesting thing was we always used to nickname him Tex, this particular officer, and I never quite knew why. I always thought he'd been in the tank corps during the war, and I thought he carried his revolver on his hip as opposed to the waist where most of the officers carried them. But he said no, he said it wasn't that. He said, "You're only the second person that I've come across that knew my nickname was Tex." And he said, "I got it because when I used to stand talking to the lads, I used to stick my thumbs in my webbing belt and stand there, and that was how he became known as Tex to us." But he is the only one I've met through the Airlift Association. I do know one other who still lives in Leicester, who I was with an awful lot, and I haven't seen him for several years, but I probably could trace him even now.
Did you have very close links with the police? You know, the military police, the RAF police?
Not if we could help it.
Oh, I would have thought there would have been...
Yes, we did, but in general, military police aren't very kindly looked upon by other servicemen. Wrongly so. I mean, I had friends that were in the service police, but generally it's a little bit of an us and them situation as far as that was concerned. So yes, we did work with them on the security, but we were never very close.
And how about civilian police? Would there have been sort of a police force then in Germany?
Yes, the Germans did have police, but we didn't come into contact with them at all. They were not on the airfields, they were just in the towns and that. That's another thing. We thought the bombing was bad here, but for anybody that saw Germany immediately after the war, whatever your feelings for the Germans, you couldn't help feeling terribly sorry. I mean, the state that they were living in was absolutely appalling. Most of the largest cities, Hanover, Hamburg, Berlin, were absolutely flattened, and all there were sort of roads bulldozed through the rubble. And most of the Germans were living in cellars and places like that. And Germany gets very, very cold in the winter. And that was another point for the people in Berlin in particular. Their domestic coal ration was handed to them in shopping bags. So you can tell how small the allowance was. And the German women used to go out into the woods round about scavenging wood and that to try and improve their heating. But it was a very, very hard life for them. The rations were obviously minute. But the sheer volume of the stuff that had to be flown into Berlin, it's unbelievable. I mean, everything, as I say, went in. And when you realise that they needed 30 tonnes of salt a day flown in, it gives you some idea of, I mean, salt you think of as little things, but that was quite a problem to fly in because it's very corrosive, until somebody had a very bright idea that flying boats were proofed against salt water, and they flew a lot of the salt in flying boats, which was fine until the winter came and the waters froze, and then it was mainly taken in then in Holtons, which were converted Halifax bombers that had a big pannier underneath, and if the salt spilt out, it went out in the slipstream and didn't damage the aircraft. Everything went in. There were two airfields when the airlift started, Tempelhof and Gattau in Berlin, and they needed a third one, so they built one in the French zone at Tegel, and they needed some earth-moving machinery. Well, there were no aircraft big enough to carry a lot of this machinery, and so most of it was cut in two with acetylene torches, taken in two separate pieces, and then welded together again in the city. And the French part in the airlift, they had very, very few aircraft in those days, just a few former German Ju-52s, and they were so clapped out that it was decided that they'd be better off the airlift, and they were removed from the airlift at a fairly early stage. But when Tegel was built in the French zone, the Russians had a radio mast which was in the way of the aircraft. It was rather too close, and the Russians were requested to remove it, and they wouldn't. So the French commandos went over and put explosives at the foot of it and blew it up. And the Russians were furious over this, of course, and said, well, how could you do it? How could you do it? And the French commandant said, simple, mon général, TNT. That was probably one of their greatest contributions to the airlift. One of the amusing stories. The other thing, going back onto the loads, I remember one dumper that had to be got into Berlin, and they were trying to get it into a York, and it wouldn't go because the main spar of a York ran over the top of the cabin, and they couldn't get it under that. And then somebody had a bright idea that they would let the tyres down, grease the floor and slide it in, which they did. But when they got it in there, they decided, well, this was too good an opportunity. So they got a whole host of Germans cleaning the floor and getting all the grease off, and then they blew the tyres up again. And a telex message came back from Gatto when the aircraft arrived. All right, clever devils, how did you get it in? And so there was still humour that went on to a large extent. The other story that's always told is the pilots always called their load as they came into the Berlin airfield, and one pilot called that he got a load of gin, and the radio went very silent, and then a voice said, land very gently, and those were all the instructions he got. So yes, there was still a lot of humour went on, and those are just one or two of the incidents I remember. I also remember one of the Yorks taking off from Wunstorf crashed at the end of the runway and slid along. We happened to be on the airfield at the time and went tearing over to see if we could help the crew. The crew were all out but one, and he was on his hands and knees at the side of the aircraft, and we thought he was probably stunned, and of course the first thing you do if an aircraft crashes is get the people away from it, because it could blow up or anything. And we dragged this poor aircrew member away, and he called us a lot of very, very rude names for doing this. And we found out he was on his hands and knees. He dropped his cigarette lighter as he got out of the aircraft, and he was looking for it. He was most perturbed because we'd pulled him away from his aircraft, but we weren't to know.
Were there many casualties that you knew of, you know, crashes and or accidents?
Considering the amount, there weren't a lot, but there were, in fact, 78 killed on the operation of all nationalities, 39 of which were British and Commonwealth people. There were, as well as air crew, there were ground crew killed. And there were 7 German children killed, which was very tragic. They used to evacuate German children, sometimes permanently, sometimes just temporarily, to build them up, as well as old people from Berlin. And one Dakota was flying some of these children out and unfortunately crashed and killed all the children on board. But this was another job that we were supposed to do if we always feared an aircraft crashing in the Russian zone. And several did, in fact, crash in there. And one of the jobs we were supposed to do was go and get the crews out. I don't think we could have ever done it. It was all very well in theory, but in practice it would have been totally impractical, I think. But it was one of the things that we were supposed to do. But in fact, the Russians were quite good on several occasions when we did lose aircraft. In one particular case, a Dakota crashed in their zone, and there were four on board, three crew and one passenger. Two of the crew and the passenger were killed when the aircraft crashed, and the navigator survived the crash. And the Russians got him to hospital. He was very, very seriously burnt, and they let an RAF doctor and nurse through to him, and his wife was also flown from this country out to him and was with him when, in fact, he died. So there was a human side as well. The other lovely story with the Russians that is told is that there was a cafe just outside Berlin which was used by both the Russians and the British, and particularly a lot of the ground crew used to get in there. But they realised after a short time that the Russians always had an English speaking person with them who took notes of their conversation. So they started, they always used to keep a scoreboard how many flights they'd been in during the day and that. So they used to put these flights up about 50%, and they'd see this Russian looking very puzzled and writing away. So some of the stories that got back would be lovely. The Russians did harass some of the aircraft in the air corridor by flying their aircraft very close, and also having anti-aircraft practice and shining searchlights. But the pilots got their own back at Gatow, because there was a very big Russian camp right at the end of the runway, and they always used to hold the aircraft well down at night so that they went over the barracks very, very low, and not many of the Russians slept very, very well during the period of the airlift. So there was some probably rather childish behaviour in some ways that went on, but again, I suppose that's life. Yeah.
Did you ever fly to Berlin?
Yes, I flew in on one or two occasions. We weren't actually supposed to go into to Berlin unless it was on duty, but we could often scrounge a ride in, and I went in on one or two occasions, but I only went straight into the airfield and came out again. I didn't actually go into
which
into
one would
Berlin.
That have been
Gatow.
What was your impression? This would have been during a normal Berlin airlift flight, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
Delivering, you
yes.
know. Can you describe that, what it was like going along the corridors from Wunsdorf?
Yes, it was no different, really, to flying anywhere else. I mean, though these corridors were about 10 miles wide, you weren't conscious that you were the navigator would be working hard to make sure that the aircraft kept into those corridors, because the Russians had always threatened to shoot down any that strayed out, and they obviously didn't want to tempt them. But other than that, there was very little difference of flying anywhere else. When you arrived, again, it was very much like it was at the other end, only they were unloading them. The British did also fly out quite a lot of things from Berlin. Any manufactured goods, for instance, were the British flew most of those out. And if it was anything that was packed in a wooden packing case, they always used to put a stamp on them, made in blockaded Berlin, with the Berlin Bear on it as well. And the children, the RAF flew most of those out. There was one York had some German passengers, including a very elderly lady, on board, and unfortunately, as it took off, one of the undercarriage legs collapsed, and the plane skidded across the airfield, and there was no way this German lady was going back into the aircraft. She said no, she'd stop in Berlin sooner than face a flight like that again. So, but other than the one aircraft crash, which was very tragic when the children were killed, there were no civilian casualties from that. There were quite a few killed on the ground in accidents, because all the airfields were very, very busy, and where most of your vehicles moving about on the airfield these days have these strobe flashing lights on them, there were no such things in those days. And one lorry with some ground crew on board did unfortunately drive into the path of a taxiing aircraft, and several of the ground crew were killed. And there was another case where a civilian pilot was run over and killed under rather suspicious circumstances, because the lorry that ran him over was never found, and nobody really knows, even to this day, what and why it happened. There's always plenty of stories, but the truth, I don't think, ever came out on that.
Yes. You know, going in with the airlift, one imagines, because one hears about the timings of the landing, that it would be much busier, the skies. Did you not find that the sky... Was it not obvious that they were landing every 3 minutes?
Obviously, if you were on the airfield, yes, it was very, very much so. Actually flying in, it wasn't quite so obvious. Yes, you saw other aircraft, but... not a lot. I mean, the basic idea, there were three corridors that were used in the airlift, and the basic idea was that the traffic flew in on the outside legs and out through the centre. That there were some exceptions to that, but basically that was the idea. And of course, the Americans were flying quite a bit further from their zone, so they did move some of the American aircraft onto RAF airfields, mainly Fassberg and Sella, and they flew from those airfields during the airlift. And there's one very nice story when the Americans moved into one of these airfields, and the Texan master sergeant that was in charge of the mess didn't think his equipment was up to standard, and although the airfields then became under American control, they still left a British commanding officer there. And so the commanding officer received these complaints from this Texan master sergeant, and he thought he'd better go and find out what happened. Well, to those I was in the RAF, the station master was God. But to this Texan master sergeant, he was just an RAF officer. And he said, "What do I call you?" So he said, "Well, my name is Group Captain Smythe." "Ah," oh, he said, "I'll call you Captain then." And he went round, and he was quite helpful to this Texan master sergeant. And the Texan was feeling quite pleased with him when he went, and he said, "Well, Captain," he said, if you ever want a steak," he said, "you come along and see me," he said, "I'll fix you up." And then he turned around and he saw he'd got a WAF driver, and he said, "And if your popsy wants any coffee, tell her to come and see me." Well, this to anybody in the Air Force was quite an amusing story.
Quite a culture shock,
Yes.
How did the Americans and the British get on generally? You know, and there were South Africans as well.
Oh, yeah. There was some rivalry, but generally, I think, pretty well. Obviously, there were clashes, but we we went to Fassburg and spent some time with them, and we liked it very much because, as I say, their messes were very, very different to ours, the standard of food. They didn't have plates as we had them. They had a steel tray, rather like a baking tray, with different compartments punched in it, and each course went into one of the, which was always very good, because occasionally they ate things which weren't to our taste, and it didn't taint the rest of the meal. But they always had things like fresh milk and fruit juice and things that we never saw there. There were flying fresh milk and cream in from Scandinavia daily. So they live quite well, the Americans, and their PX to us again was an Aladdin's cave, far, far in advance of our NAFI shops. And the only problem was they used a different currency to us. They used occupation dollars, and it was not easy for us to get to exchange our money for the American money, because the only thing the Americans wanted to buy that we had was beer, and they liked our beer better than their own.
How about South Africans? Did you meet many?
No, I can't honestly say I ever came across any. They were there, and they were flying, I believe, mainly the Dakotas in there. But again, we were fairly separate from the air crews. We didn't see an awful lot of the air crews, except when we were actually on the airfield and that. And then they were just air crew, not somebody that we ever got to know personally.
Why had you gone to Fassburg? You know, what was the reason for that?
We used to go for quite a few things there. Just close to Fassburg, it comes up to Lüneburg Heath, and the heath there was a practice range, and still is, I think, quite a bit of it, even to these days. And we used to go up there for firing anti-tank weapons and things like that. And again, it was generally, if I went up driving load that were going to fire on the range, or one of our officers on a liaison visit.
Well, driving in Germany, you know, that area, what were the roads like, you know, given all the bombing that had occurred?
I think they were perhaps worse than they are here, but not too bad. There wasn't, of course, the amount of traffic on them. Most of the traffic was military traffic, but there was civilian traffic, but nothing to compare with these days. Most service vehicles are made to go over rough country, so rough roads didn't worry them a great deal.
And you had plenty of petrol, did you always?
Oh yes, we had it. Yes, we used to wash our clothes in it.
Did you, the sort of supply situation, you know, the goods coming into Germany to be flown to Berlin, were you involved with that sort
no,
of chain at all?
Not really, no. No, as far as we were concerned, it just appeared, and, you know, there were, obviously, there were a lot of people involved with that, and in fact, this was one of the, in the early days, the military were notorious for forms. Everything you had to fill in three forms for, and this started off with the airlift, and apparently they very soon bogged themselves down. They got more papers than anything, and a lot of them were withdrawn. But in the early days, that was apparently a major snag.
Saying about the situation of the German people. Were you able to fraternise?
No, it wasn't encouraged then, and Yeah, we had some working. Obviously, there were many hundreds working on the airfield and that, but there wasn't a lot of fraternisation between the military and the civilian.
I was wondering about, you know, girls as well, German women.
Obviously there were some of the fellas met German girls and were friendly with
them.
Was that
against the rules? Was it, you know?
It was. I don't remember it being strictly against the rules, but it wasn't encouraged. I think that's probably a better way of describing the situation in those days.
Do you think, and you were saying earlier about your sort of change of attitudes towards the Germans, did the airlift make a difference, do you think, for changing the feelings with, you know, Germans towards the British and vice versa?
Yeah, I think the whole lot helped towards that situation. As I say, you'd have to be very, very hard-hearted not to feel very, very sorry for the way that many of them lived. But I don't... it softened my attitude, definitely, but I don't think it's until the 50th anniversary that it really made a major impact. And then you begin to realise. I mean, Gail Holverson, who was the Kandy bomber, was speaking at one of the receptions in Berlin, and he said that 50 years ago we gave you 11 short months. Since then you've given us 50 years. And this is very true. I mean, the Germans got the Airlift Foundation going, and they paid all the widows a pension, and all the children they educated at public schools. When the 50th anniversary was coming up, Heinz Gerd said to some of the RAF people that had gone back to Germany, look, the 50th anniversary is coming up, we want to invite you back to Berlin. The Americans have got an association, you haven't. We can't invite you back. And this was when the Airlift Association was formed. And when it was first muted that they would invite us back to Berlin, we were told that they would pay everything. And I said, well, for goodness sake, don't tell people that, because there's no way they'll be able to do that. We took between 750 and 1,000 back from this country. And the Germans paid every penny. They paid the airfares, they paid our hotel bills, they paid all the entertainment. And the generosity that they showed us was unbelievable. I just didn't think they could collect that sort of money, but they did. And the different things... I think in the main it was small things that people would come up to us and recognise us in the streets and say thank you, thank you. There was one occasion that there was an open air concert and the mayor of Berlin was there, and he asked us to stand, and the they gave us a 5-minute standing ovation, and that was something I'll never forget. Can you stop it?